Well, good afternoon, everyone. In one of the greatest moments of cinematic history, appeared on screen May 25th, 1983. I wasn't even two months old yet. Star Wars, Episode 6, The Return of the Jedi. It was originally called Revenge of the Jedi, but they realized that revenge didn't really fit with the theme of the movie. It wasn't about the Jedi taking vengeance, it was about redemption, a return. So they changed the name of the movie to Return of the Jedi. As the evil Emperor Palpatine is using force lightning to attack Luke Skywalker, the defeated Darth Vader is looking on while Luke is writhing in pain. Finally, overcome with a sense of unresolved grief and anger and purpose, Darth Vader grabs the Emperor and throws him to his certain death. At least that's, don't ask me about the sequels. Anyway, so saving Luke, but destroying the biomechanical devices that were supporting his life. So in a moment, after nearly a lifetime of evil, Darth Vader redeemed himself. But that's just the stuff of fiction, right? Fast forward a couple of decades and we have the Marvel movies, specifically the Avengers. And then in that movie, we have this character named Black Widow. She's a spy and assassin. And throughout the movie and the entire rest of the series, really, the motivation for her character is seeking redemption. As she said quite often, I've got red in my ledger and I'd like to wipe it out. Loki says to her, can you? Can you wipe out that much red? She finally dies, sacrificing herself in one last push to obtain redemption for her past mistakes. Is redemption really possible at all? Does redemption really happen? We live in a world today that really refuses to forgive. It doesn't matter how long ago something was or how much you might have changed, the people of this world will dredge up whatever dirt they can. Forgiveness just doesn't exist in today's world. Even if you do change, people will refuse to change how they see you. In their minds, your fate is sealed. That begins to affect us, how we see ourselves. Well, they'll always see me that way, so what's the point in even trying? Is it possible to redeem yourself? Is it possible to change your fate? The Bible records an interesting account of two tribes on whom were pronounced the same fate. They were lumped together and given the same, rather grim, prophecy. At the end of Jacob's life, he prophesied about his sons, and we can read what he said about Simeon and Levi. In Genesis chapter 49, and we'll pick it up in verses 5 through 7. Go to the right place. Genesis 49. Verse 5. Simeon and Levi are brothers, instruments of cruelty in their dwelling place. Let not my soul enter their council, let not my honor be united to their assembly. For in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they hamstrung an ox. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. They slew a man, they hamstrung an ox. That's a little bit of an odd phrase. Now, to give you a warning, the only things I know about Hebrew is stuff I learned from random people on the internet, but the word for ox here is shor, okay? It differs from another word by just the tiniest little vowel mark called a colon. It hints how the word should be pronounced. Otherwise, it looks exactly the same as this other word. The translators of the King James Version believed that this was the Hebrew word shur, not shor, which means Shur means wall. The Midrash of Genesis, which is like the Jewish commentary on the Bible, agrees with the King James Version and believes that this should be translated as a wall instead of ox. Now, the word for hamstrung is a little bit less interesting. In a literal sense, it means to cut. Figuratively, it means to dig down, to pluck up by the roots, to exterminate. So these two things seem kind of different, you know, cut, dig down, pluck up by the roots. But think about weeds in your garden, right, or in your lawn. We cut them down. We pluck them. We exterminate them, okay? And there's this sense, at least hopefully, there's a sense of permanence about it. They come right back, but you get what I mean. So what happened? What had they done? We don't have a record of them hamstringing an ox, but we do have a record of them destroying a wall. Genesis 34 records the incident where Simeon and Levi took vengeance on an entire city. They were angry, and if you know the story, I'm not going to turn there, but if you know the story, they were rightly angry. So, again, I don't want to get into the details, but they took their anger much, much too far. After convincing all of the men to be circumcised, while they were in pain and unable to fight, they attacked and killed all of the men of the city, and then they plundered the city. In their anger, they eradicated an entire city. Not exactly the kind of behavior that God was expecting from his chosen people. God recognized that anger in them, and through Jacob, pronounced a prophecy. He would divide and scatter them. Did his prophecy come to pass? Now, I know what you're thinking, Andy, don't be silly. As we all know from Yul Brynner and the Ten Commandments, this is prophecy. It will come to pass, right? Doesn't all prophecy come to pass? That's their fate. Is fate sealed, or do we have some control? Did Levi's fate come to pass? Let's turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 33, and we'll pick up in verse 8. Deuteronomy chapter 33. The Israelites are about to cross over into the promised land after wandering for 40 years in the wilderness, and Moses is about to die, and he speaks to each of the tribes. Deuteronomy 33 and verse 8. My phone is not playing nice with me, so I apologize. Verse 8, and of Levi he said, let your Thummim and your Urim be with your Holy One, whom you tested at Massah, and with whom you contended at the waters of Meribah, who said of his father and mother, I have not seen them, nor did he acknowledge his brothers, or know his own children, for they have observed your word and kept your covenant. They shall teach Jacob your judgments and Israel your law. They shall put incense before you and hold burnt sacrifice on your altar. Bless his substance, Lord, and accept the work of his hands. Strike the loins of those who rise against him and of those who hate him, that they rise not again. This is a very, very different view of Levi. God's law was more important to them than anything else, even family. That's what's talking about how they didn't regard father or mother even their own children. God's law was more important to them. We don't read anything like this before. There's nothing here about them being scattered or divided. The tone is very different. Is this a contradiction or something more? Did Levi change their fate? Now, maybe you're thinking, Andy, come on, this is just Moses going through blessing everybody, okay? It's the end of his life. You get a blessing, you get a blessing, and boom, you get a blessing, you know? Just blessing everybody, right? I mean, we read about all the different tribes here being blessed, okay? But if you scan through this chapter, you'll notice one thing. Blessing for this tribe of Benjamin, he said this. Of Joseph, he said this. And right down the line, why not one for Simeon? Simeon isn't listed here. Of the 12 tribes of Israel, the Levites are one of the few that still have an identity today. So what about what was prophesied? Well, there's different types of prophecy in the Bible. We know the word prophecy can mean many different things. There's prophecy that God says will come to pass, unchangeable. And there's prophecy that God says will come to pass unless something changes. Prophecy probably isn't the best word for that. It's more like a pronouncement, a warning. This is what will happen unless you change. The point is, it's not permanent. It's not set in stone. It isn't decided yet. In this case, God's mind can be changed. Let's look over at Exodus 24. Let's see what happened with the tribe of Levi. Exodus 24, we'll just read verses 1 and 2 here. Exodus 24, verse 1. Now he said to Moses, "Come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and the 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship from afar. And Moses alone shall come near the Lord, but they shall not come near, nor shall the people go up with him." So things are going well, right? The Israelites have just seen the destruction of Pharaoh's army. They're kind of on a little bit of a high right now, okay? And skip down to verse 9. Then Moses went up, also Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and the 70 elders of Israel, and they saw the God of Israel. And there was under his feet, as it were, a paved work of sapphire stone, and it was like the very heavens in its clarity. So Moses, Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and the 70 elders have just seen God. This is a moment of clarity for Israel, right? Things are going very well for them. And then 40 days later, let's go over to chapter 32. Moses is gone for a little while. Exodus 32 and verse 1. Now when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron and said to him, "Come make us gods that shall go before us. For this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." And Aaron said to them, "Break off the golden earrings which are on the ears of your wives, your sons, your daughters, and bring them to me." And he makes the golden calf. We know the story. Aaron, what are you doing? After everything we've just been through, what are you doing? Okay? Now skip down to verse 7. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go get down. For the people whom you brought out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made a molded calf and worshipped it, sacrificed to it, and said, 'This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt.' And the Lord said to Moses, 'I have seen this people, and indeed it is a stiff-necked people. Now therefore, let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, that I may consume them, and I will make a great nation. I will make of you a great nation.'" So God is ready to just destroy all of them and start over, okay? Moses intercedes, verse 11. Then Moses pleaded with the Lord, his God, and said, "Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians speak and say, 'He brought them out to harm them, to kill them in the mountains, and to consume them from the face of the earth'? Turn from your fierce wrath and relent from this harm to your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by your own self and said to them, 'I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and all this land that I have spoken of, I give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever.'" Moses intercedes for Israel. In verse 14, "So the Lord relented from the harm which he said he would do to his people." God relents. Now, this is a fairly basic example, but we see God's mind can be changed. He's ready to destroy the entire nation, but Moses intercedes. Now, maybe God was testing Moses to see what Moses would say. We don't know. What we have recorded for us is God was ready to destroy them, and Moses convinces him not to. So, what other evidence do we have that God's mind can be changed, that fate is not necessarily sealed? Let's turn over to Jonah chapter 1. We know the story of Jonah fairly well. Jonah chapter 1, verse 1. Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, "Arise and go to Nineveh, that great city, and cry out against it, for their wickedness has come up before me." So God tells Jonah to go to Nineveh, pronounce their fate. Again, we know the story very well. Verse 3. But Jonah arose to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. He went down to Joppa and found a ship going to Tarshish. So he paid the fare and went down to it to go with him to Tarshish from the presence of the sea, or from the presence of the Lord. Okay, so why did Jonah flee? Was he afraid of going to Nineveh? You probably couldn't blame him. He certainly had every right to be. Nineveh was a very bad place. There was no Geneva Conventions. There's no Sokovia Accords for you Marvel fans out there. The men of Nineveh were merciless and cruel. And these are the people that would later become the Assyrians, okay? Now, again, we're not going to go through a bunch here, but let's go over to chapter 3 now of Jonah. Jonah chapter 3. We know, you know, obviously he is cast off the side of the ship, he's swallowed by the whale, and then he's spit back up onto the land. Okay, so chapter 3, verse 1. Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah the second time, saying, "Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and preach to it the message that I'll tell you." So Jonah arose and went to Nineveh according to the word of the Lord. Now Nineveh was an exceedingly great city, a three-day journey in extent. And Jonah began to enter the city on the first day's walk. And then he cried out and said, "Yet 40 days and Nineveh will be overthrown." It's going to happen. Best get your mind right. No. Continuing on, verse 5. So the people of Nineveh believed God, proclaimed a fast, and put on sackcloth, from the greatest to the least of them. Then the word came to the king of Nineveh, and he arose from his throne and laid aside his robe and covered himself with sackcloth and sat in ashes. And he caused it to be proclaimed and published throughout Nineveh by the decree of the king and his nobles, saying, "Let neither man nor beast, herd nor flock, taste anything. Do not let them eat or drink water, but let man and beast be covered with sackcloth and cry mightily to the Lord. Yes, let every one of you turn from his evil way, from the violence that is in his hands. Who can tell if God will turn and relent and turn away from his fierce anger, so that we may not perish?" And then God saw their works, that they turned from their evil way, and God relented from the disaster that he said he would bring upon them, and he did not do it. And that is why Jonah fled. He knew God could change his mind. Chapter 4, verse 1. But it displeased Jonah exceedingly, and he became angry. So he prayed to the Lord and said, "Lord, was not this what I said when I was still in my country? Therefore I fled to Tarshish, for I know that you are a gracious and merciful God, slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness, one who relents from doing harm. Therefore now, O Lord, please take my life." So he's completely given up, but he was upset because he knew, even with this pronouncement that God is going to destroy the city, he knew there was a chance that if they did something, if they redeemed themselves, that God would relent. So, what did Levi do to turn their fate around? How did Levi redeem himself? We read how God was ready to wipe out Israel and build a new nation from Moses. Let's keep reading. Let's go back to Exodus 32. Exodus 32. And let's see, we read verse 14. So the Lord relented from the harm which he said he would do to the people. And Moses, verse 15, turned and went down from the mountain. And the two tablets of the testimony were in his hand. The tablets were written on both sides, on one side and on the other they were written. Skip down now to verse 25. Now Moses, when he saw the people were unrestrained, for Aaron had not restrained them, to their shame among their enemies, then Moses stood in the entrance of the camp and said, "Whoever is on the Lord's side, come to me." And all the sons of Levi gathered themselves together to him. And he said to them, "Thus says the Lord your God of Israel, let every man put on his sword on his side and go in and out from the entrance to entrance throughout the camp. And let every man kill his brother, every man his neighbor, every man his companion, every man his neighbor." So the sons of Levi did according to the word of Moses. And about 3,000 men of the people fell that day. Then Moses said, "Consecrate yourselves now, today, to the Lord, that he may bestow on you a blessing this day, for every man has opposed his son and his brother." And that's what that blessing in Deuteronomy 33 was talking about. They gave no regard for even their own family members. They showed zeal for God. The Levites came forward. They stepped up and said, "We're on God's side." So while so many others had quickly forgotten God, the Levites were zealous for God, and they followed God's command without partiality. They changed their fate. They turned their anger into zeal, their self-will into God's will. So instead of being scattered like Simeon was, they became something special to God. We turn over to Numbers chapter 8. Numbers chapter 8. I'll pick it up in verse 13. "And you shall stand to the Levites," God speaking, "before Aaron and his sons, and then offer them like a wave offering to the Lord." The Levites are consecrated before God. Instead of Levi being scattered, God says he's taken them as his own. In the final plague on Egypt, God struck down the firstborn of the Egyptians, and he said the lives of the firstborn of the Israelites were also his, except in their place he would take the Levites. The Levites would be dedicated to serving God in the tabernacle and later the temple. So the Levites changed their fate. Fate can be changed. The only time that fate is certain is when we do nothing to change it. So now we know the whole rest of the story of Israel. Israel as a nation went on to reject God and were lost to the pages of history for the most part. That's their fate. Or was it? Is that the rest of the story? Let's turn now to Romans. Romans chapter 10, verse 21. "But to Israel he says, 'All day long I have stretched out my hands to a disobedient and contrary people.'" Israel was disobedient, so God rejected them. Chapter 11, skip down to verse 7. "What then? Israel has not obtained what it seeks, but the elect have obtained it, and the rest were blinded." So because of their disobedience, God cut them off. Skip down to verse 17. "And if some of the branches were broken off, and you, being a wild olive tree, were grafted in among them, and with them became a partaker of the root and fatness of the olive tree." So God cut them off from salvation, from the tree of life. With these branches cut off, the opportunity is now available to everyone, anyone, to be grafted into that tree of life. So the promise of salvation is open to everyone. God said, "This is the tree of life. It's available to Israel. Israel was disobedient, so the disobedient branches were cut off, and now there's room for anyone else to be grafted into the tree in their place." Verse 19. "You will say then, 'Branches were cut off that I might be grafted in.'" Branches were cut off to give me a chance at redemption. So even in redemption, we may be feeling like we're not even worthy of it. Okay, there again is the world trying to make us feel like, no, you haven't changed. You're not worthy. Okay? And what does God say to that? Verse 20. Well said. That's what God says. Well said. Because of unbelief, they were broken off, and you stand by faith. Do not be haughty, but fear. Verse 21. For if God did not spare the natural branches, he may not spare you either. Okay? Well said. They were broken off because of unbelief, and if God didn't spare his own people, the Israelites, well, why would he spare anyone? You see, even if we change our fate, we're not done. Even if we redeem ourselves, we still have work to do. We have to keep working. We have to keep striving to be obedient. Verse 22. Therefore, consider the goodness and severity of God. On those who fell, severity, but toward you, goodness, if you continue in his goodness. Otherwise, you also will be cut off. If we fall back into our old ways, we'll be cut off again. Here's the amazing part. Verse 23. And they also, if they do not continue in unbelief, will be grafted in. For God is able to graft them in again. For if you were cut out of the olive tree, which is wild by nature, and were grafted contrary to nature into a cultivated tree, how much more will these, who are natural branches, be grafted into their own olive tree? If God is able to extend the promise of salvation to anyone, then even those who have been cut off still have the opportunity to become a part of God's family. It's like that episode of The King of Queens. Alicia loves that show, and even though I kind of tease her about it, I like it too. But there's this episode where the main character, Doug, he's talking to his father-in-law, Arthur, and Arthur says, in my book, it's the losers who are the real winners. And so Doug says, well, then what about the winners? Arthur responds, well, they're still the winners. You can't take that away from them. After all, they won, okay? So these branches that have been broken off, the natural branches that have been broken off, can still be grafted back in. So even though they've gone off and been disobedient, they can still be grafted back in. They are redeemable. Their fate is not sealed. Verse 29. For the gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable. God's calling is irrevocable. The door is always open. It's never too late to change our fate. I think about other scriptures, you know, that talk about how this isn't saying once saved, always saved. We've just read how, if we are disobedient, we will be cut off. And there is that point where someone has walked away so far that God says, well, they've lost their chance. There is that moment. But that's not up to us to judge, thankfully. That's up to God to judge. But as far as we are concerned, it's never too late for us to change our fate. Verse 30. For as you were once disobedient to God, yet have now obtained mercy through their disobedience, even so these also have now been disobedient, that through the mercy shown you, they also obtain mercy. Israel's disobedience led to salvation being made available to anyone that God may call. And because salvation is open to anyone God may call and extend his mercy to, then his mercy is available to those who've gotten so far off course that they've been cut off. How mind-boggling is that? Verse 33, oh, the depths of the riches, both of the wisdom and the knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out. For who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has become his counselor, or who has first given to him that it shall be repaid to him? God's mercy for us is incomparable to anything. God wants us to be a part of his family. There is no end to his mercy and his eagerness to bring anyone back in the fold who seeks to change, who seeks redemption. And so we should continue to seek redemption. And unlike the world, which is unforgiving, we must be like God, extending mercy to our brethren as they seek redemption too. One final scripture, 2 Peter chapter 1. And let's see here. We'll just pick it up we'll pick it up in verse 5. But also for this very reason, giving all diligence, add to your faith virtue, to virtue knowledge, to knowledge self-control, to self-control perseverance, to perseverance godliness, to godliness brotherly love, and to brotherly kindness, and to brotherly kindness love. For if these things are yours and abound, you will neither be barren nor unfruitful in the knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. But for he who lacks these things is short-sighted, even to blindness, and forgotten that he was cleansed from his old sins. So when we do that, we are blinded to the fact that we've been redeemed also, that the fact that we were cut off and grafted in. We've been redeemed. We've changed our fate. Through Jacob, God pronounced the fate of Levi. It may have taken a few hundred years, but the lineage of Levi redeemed themselves. Levi's fate was not sealed, and neither is ours.